Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 250. Today's guest is Dr. Allison Rogers, who is board certified in both obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive endocrinology and infertility. She currently practices at the Fertility Centers of Illinois, which you can find online at www.fcionline.com. After Dr. Rogers answers a few listener questions, we discuss the possible risks of IVF to both mother and baby. If you have a fertility question you'd like Dr. Rogers to answer in an upcoming episode, go to beatinfertility.co/ask. And if you'd like to speak to Dr. Rogers directly for a second opinion via Skype, contact her office at 877-324-4483. Don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus250. Take a listen. Hey, Dr. Rogers, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Heather.
We are going to start, as always, with some listener questions. The first one is from Jessica. She says, I am 37 and my husband is 36. I spoke with a genetic counselor about my low-level mosaic with a 9q duplication that my doctor is willing to transfer. We are hesitant to transfer, even though it has a survivable condition. So for now, we will hold off. Complicating this already torturous decision about our mosaic is that the genetic counselor told me that some doctors simply want a pass-fail based on percentage instead of information on mosaicism, and that this embryo would have passed as normal under those criteria. Does FCI just do a pass-fail for PGTA?
So this is a great question. And I think the heart of this question is, should you be transferring mosaic embryos, number one? And then the other part of this question is sort of where the normal and not normal lines are and where your clinic is. So when the ideas of mosaicism first came out, we had them report everything. At Fertility Centers of Illinois, we have decided that it created a lot of patients who were upset, and just the science wasn't there to really support using mosaic embryos, and there's a lot of risk. And so we have asked for them to say normal, not normal, and not get a mosaic level. So this is the interesting thing about the testing. So they take, remember, the embryo is about 200 cells, and they take about 5 cells for genetic analysis. And we get like a percentage of how many of those cells were normal and how many weren't. Theoretically, they should all be normal or all be abnormal. But there's some inherent error in the testing, and it's about 20%. So it is impossible to distinguish an embryo with 1 out of 5 cells being abnormal versus one that is 100% normal, and it's just the error in the testing. That is where these complications can arise. So 20% is where the cutoff is, because it's completely unable to distinguish normal versus a mosaic that's less than 20%. Things more than 20% are mosaic and not transferable in our clinic, so we call them abnormal. But I think that's a very clinic-by-clinic decision. I would say there's really no clinics that I'm aware of. Clearly there's some, but transferring mosaic embryos outside of, I think Stanford is doing a research trial on transferring mosaic embryos. Remember, mosaic embryos mean that this embryo does have extra chromosomes or missing chromosomes. The question really is that going to lead to most, you know, they've done this in Europe. There was a study with, I think, about 100 pregnancies in Europe. And what they found was that most of them ended in no pregnancy or miscarriage, and that there were some that resulted in a normal pregnancy, but we don't have enough long-term data to say that if a baby survives, it's going to be healthy with extra chromosomes or missing chromosomes. Remember, mosaicism means the embryo has multiple different kinds of cells. So what the cells are in the intercell mass of the blastocyst is really what is going to be going to be making the baby. If there's mosaicism or abnormal cells in the placenta, it doesn't matter quite as much. And so I think that this is an area of medicine that there's, you know, we're still learning and exploring and trying to figure out what the right answer is. And every clinic is going to do this a little bit different.
I just want to clarify one thing you said. You mentioned a 20% error rate. You're not talking about the overall
correct
reliability of PGT-A.
No, yes. PGT-A is incredibly reliable, but the data that we get back kind of looks like squiggles on a page, right? And the amplitude of the squiggles is about 20%, can be up to 20% and still be normal. So it's hard to determine whether 20% of the cells are abnormal or whether it's just normal and that's the squiggles that we're seeing. So certainly the test results are very, very accurate, where it's a 98%, 99%. But of the cells we get, it's impossible to distinguish an embryo that has a 20% mosaic situation versus an embryo that is completely normal. So that's where it becomes really hard.
This next question is a long one, so bear with me. This is from Avril. She says, I am a 41-year-old single lady with mild PCOS and no other health conditions. I have completed 2 rounds of IVF with PGT and 3 FETs. My first FET ended in a biochemical. We didn't change anything for the second FET, which ended in a 6-week miscarriage. I just had a third loss at 5 weeks following my third FET. After the second loss, I did a hysteroscopy, full thrombophilia screen, and immunology panel. The hysteroscopy and clotting screening came back normal. My NK cells came back moderately high. For my last FET, I did a high-dose omega-3 for 6 weeks prior to my transfer, down-regulated with the UK equivalent to Lupron, then aspirin, PIO, steroids, clexane, intralipids, estrogen, and metformin. Each time, while my HCG doubled normally initially, I never felt confident because it was always on the low side of average. I also always had off and on low-level cramping. My RE is now suggesting karyotyping testing to see if I have a translocation. If the result is negative, my RE is suggesting doing a natural FET. I had suggested an ERA, but since I had implantation each time, he doesn't think that this is an issue. If I do have a translocation, then it will be another round of IVF with PGTD. I'm at a loss both emotionally and financially and would absolutely love to hear your ideas.
I am not sure what PGTD is. That's not something that we do, but maybe she meant A. So a couple things about this question for Avril. You know, the question is why was one of the ovaries inaccessible? This happens often when patients are obese, but I'm not sure. Sometimes there can be scar tissue in the pelvis or endometriosis that makes an ovary stuck behind the uterus. So you just got to wonder what else is going on in her pelvis that they couldn't get to an ovary. And a lot of times it's because patients are obese. Certainly, obesity plays a role in pregnancy and being able to sort of sustain a pregnancy. And I absolutely have had some patients who have lost significant amounts of weight and then are successful. I will tell you that there is really not great science about IVIG or Humira or the natural killer cells. And I really don't, you know, steroids even. I mean, the whole thing, there's a great article from the American Society of Reproductive Medicine that just says there's really not data to support doing that and potential harm. So I would say for this patient, you know, looking for endometritis or inflammation in the uterus, I do think that probably an ERA might be helpful, but I agree if implantation is happening. When you're having trouble with recurrent loss, I absolutely think a full evaluation needs to be done, including karyotype, wondering why it hasn't been done already. And the other thing is that there can be small deletions or genetic factors that are not picked up by the test. It's possible that either the embryos aren't as normal as you thought at 41, there's a high likelihood that the embryos aren't as normal as you thought, or that the uterus isn't as normal as you thought. So I think that looking for endometritis, looking for any other medical conditions in your body that may, you know, such as obesity, for example, that may be playing a role in this, or exposure to toxins like smoke, those all certainly can play a role And I certainly would recommend getting as much data as you can. And certainly another round would probably be a good idea because times, you know, at 41, time is certainly not on your side.
Another clarification for this question. So would PGTA catch a translocation? And if not, what testing would her embryos need?
Okay, so what the thing we look for is PGTSR, which is pre-implantation genetic testing for structural rearrangement. And they look to make sure that the little pieces of chromosomes that are stuck together or broken off are all there. They just have to look for the markers of where the genetic breaks are and assume that, you know, and try to make sure the embryo has all the ones they need.
The next question is from Allison. She says, I am 27 and my partner is 25. We have been trying to conceive for nearly 4 years and I have had 5 miscarriages and very few answers as to why. My AMH was 1.04 in 2017 and 1.81 in 2019. My TSH has been as low as 2.06 and as high as 3.49. All pregnancies ended in miscarriage around 10 or 11 weeks. My last pregnancy, I was instructed by an MFM to take low-dose aspirin and folic acid. What would you suggest as next steps? Should I get further testing?
I absolutely would recommend that this patient get further testing, likely with a reproductive endocrinologist. And this patient and her partner need to be screened for, very similar to the last question, translocations to see if there's any chromosomes sticking together. She needs to be screened for anaphospholipid antibody syndrome, any hormone imbalances. And I will say an AMH of 1 at 27 is quite low, and I would probably recommend that get evaluated as well. And this patient at the end probably needs IVF with pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy to make sure that healthy embryos are being put back in.
The next question is from Suzanne. She says, I am 35 and my husband is 48. After a year of trying on our own and 5 IUIs, we have moved on to IVF. We are doing 3 retrievals back to back with PGTA and hoping to freeze about 10 normal embryos with the hope of having 3 children. I've heard from many sources that frozen transfers are better for the mom and fetus because you clear the IVF drugs from your system. Do you think I will have a better chance of a healthy pregnancy and birth if I do a frozen transfer? I've heard you say that you do fresh transfers, but I thought most people were moving away from this practice. It's cheaper, and I'm anxious to do a fresh transfer following my upcoming retrieval, but I don't want to waste an embryo.
So what I would say to Suzanne is that she is doing something called embryo banking for future use. And at 35, it's probably a good idea. I will say that we do fresh transfers. We do mostly frozens, but we do some fresh transfers. I think maybe 25% of the transfers I do on any given day are fresh, rest are frozen. When you're doing a fresh transfer, you can't do genetic testing. And so if you are planning on doing 3 cycles back to back, you can't have a fresh transfer with cycle 1 or 2 because you're banking. So you really need to be able to do the genetic testing and for that, you need to freeze embryos. Now, I certainly have had situations where patients will say, I have however many banked embryos they want. I want to do this one last cycle. Even if I get no more healthy embryos, I still am ready to move forward with transferring. And sometimes patients will choose to transfer 1 embryo during their fresh cycle and any remaining embryos they can do PGT on. It depends on your lab. And so I would certainly talk to your doctor about it. In our lab, fresh and frozen do equally good, but that's really variable by lab.
I would also just add that my daughter was a fresh transfer, but of course, this was nearly 5 years ago now. It was back in June of 2015. And we did a fresh transfer and did PGT on the remaining embryos. But science has really changed a lot since then.
Yep. We do that all the time still, though.
The next question is from Andrea. She has a couple of questions here, so bear with me. She says, I am 37 and my husband is 39. We have been trying to conceive for 2 years and have had 2 miscarriages. Testing found a blocked fallopian tube on the left, FSH of 20 plus, and an AMH of 0.7. I had an appendectomy when I was 5. After 3 rounds of IVF, we have 3 embryos. My doctor suggested we do a uterine biopsy and an ERA with a mock transfer. My results showed I have an H score of 2.2. I had my lining checked at week 2 of the mock transfer, and it was 8.9 millimeters, which gave my doctor no reason to think my inflammation is severe. We are going to try for another HSG to see if my tube can be unblocked or if I will need surgery. My questions: does the appendicitis have anything to do with my blocked fallopian tubes or possible endometriosis? 2, if my tubes are blocked after my second HSG, do you recommend surgery for removal of my left tube prior to transfer? And finally, 3, is there anything else you'd recommend beyond my current treatment protocol?
So let's go through those questions. So appendicitis, especially ruptured, can cause inflammation in the pelvis. The appendix sits on your right side. And so typically when you see this from appendicitis, it's on the right or right plus left. It would be pretty unusual for the appendix to be sitting on the right, but the inflammation to have happened on the left. So probably not in this situation. The other thing is that if you have an HSG and you have a hydrosalpinx, so fluid in the tubes, you absolutely should have that removed before doing a transfer, as this is a situation where the fluid can leak back into the uterus, decrease the chances of pregnancy, and dramatically increase the chance of miscarriage. It's hard to know whether any previous miscarriages were from that. So absolutely would recommend that. If this patient does have endometriosis at the time of surgery that is found because of that receptiva test, that high test, then either surgery and or suppressing with either Lupron or Alyssa may be a really good thing to do before another transfer.
The last question is from Laura. She says, I am 33 and my husband is 36. I'm about to finish my 4th failed single FET and I'm really considering transferring to next time. Also, I live in Germany, which doesn't allow genetic testing, so I'm unsure whether or not my embryos are normal. You often say that transferring 2 embryos doesn't increase your chance of a live birth and just speeds up the process of finding the right embryo. But since the embryo is kind of communicating with the uterine lining upon entering the uterus, one might think that 2 embryos lead to a more intense interaction with the lining of the womb and hence make it easier for an embryo to implant. What are your thoughts about this?
Okay, so no science sort of shows that more embryos increase the chances because of some sort of communicating factors. What I would say is each embryo has to interact with the endometrium itself. And so if it's normal, it'll do that. And if the uterus is normal, it will do that. For this patient who can't do PGT, I would certainly, and has had 4 failed transfers, I certainly think 2 is probably, you know, the risks probably outweigh, or the benefits outweigh the risks. You have to sort of wonder, Laura, why have you had 4 transfers without success? Because at age 33, you probably at least 2 of, if not 3 of those were genetically normal. So I certainly would recommend further uterine evaluation and ERA if possible, because I think that you have to sort of try to figure out if it's, my guess is it's something more than just the embryos being genetically abnormal, but I certainly would look into that further.
And just to clarify, my doctor always explained it to me that each embryo has its own chance of implanting. So each of her 2 embryos that she puts in there, they're not helping each other. They're just, they each have their own chance.
Right. Correct.
Okay. Let's move into the main topic of today, which is the possible risks of IVF. Studies have come out in recent years and even recent weeks that indicate there may be risks to both the mother and the baby as a result of IVF, especially compared to spontaneous pregnancies. I sort of want to go through each of them so listeners understand and can make informed decisions for their family. Let's start with the mother. Often people wonder about the fertility medication side effects. So what are some common side effects, both short-term and long-term?
So when we think about, I think there's so much misinformation and misperceptions and just people thinking wrong, not scientifically accurate things. So this is such an important topic. When we think about short-term side effects, typically on IVF medication, people feel great. Should you have a genetic predisposition for blood clotting, you may have an increased risk of getting a blood clot in your legs or lungs. Obviously, also the medication can cause ovarian hyperstimulation. And those are sort of some of the short term. There's really not any known long term side effects from this treatment. And one of the things that often I get asked about is, does fertility treatment cause cancer? There's been extensive studies looking at this, and there's not been any cancers associated with fertility treatment. Now, patients who have not had a pregnancy and are infertile themselves, whether they do IVF or not, whether they adopt a child or do IVF, are at risk for some cancers. They're at risk for breast cancer, uterine cancer, and ovarian cancer. So actually doing the treatment and getting pregnant may lower those risks, but it's not from the treatment themselves. It's from the people who are infertile that are at a little bit increased risk for this.
Is there anything that we can do to minimize the risks of all of the side effects, possibly the short-term ones?
Yeah. So I think that if you are somebody who has a family history of blood clots, then you should probably get evaluated for it. And if you are somebody who, for example, has history of polycystic ovaries or are very young, know that they have a high AMH, then you're certainly at risk for ovarian hyperstimulation. So this is certainly something you need to really talk to your doctor about and talk about sort of minimizing those risks. And in terms of the longer term risks of female cancers, obviously getting good gynecologic care, getting mammograms and pap smears and which looks for cervical cancer, which is not one of the cancers increased, but looking, you know, getting pelvic exams and making sure that if you have irregular bleeding, you're getting evaluated long term, but also actually going through the fertility treatment and getting pregnant and having a successful pregnancy will help reduce some of that risk.
Is there anything else you think listeners need to know about fertility medications?
Well, I just think that it's really important to sort of identify from a physician's perspective, identify patients who are at higher risk for these conditions, and then be able to change up protocols or consider sort of freezing embryos instead of transferring fresh, or sort of adjusting things for that particular patient in front of you to minimize that patient's risks. Overall, the risk of ovarian hyperstimulation is about 5%. Something like a blood clot is probably less than 1 in 1,000.
You mentioned OHSS a couple of times, but what exactly is that?
So ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome is a over-response of the ovaries to the treatment. And it's mediated by something called IGF-1 or insulin-like growth factor 1. And it comes typically from HCG. The HCG isn't typically the form of the trigger, but sometimes it also can be in the form of the HCG coming from the pregnancy. And that's sort of the delayed onset. So we see it either peaking at their sort of bimodal peak. So there's either a peak a week after trigger, or there's also a week right around that sort of 4 to 5 week pregnant time. You know, there's mild hyperstimulation where patients just sort of get swollen ovaries, and it can go all the way up to really severe where patients have fluid in their, they get ascites or fluid in their belly, which can also get into their lungs. It makes their blood thick, which can lead to blood clots. And patients often are, you know, have a hard time eating because there's so much fluid, and it's really self-limited and pretty minimal. And it's really probably 1% of patients get severe like that. And mild hyperstimulation can be as common as 5%. Remember, as doctors, we need to push patients to the point where we get the most number of eggs without getting them sick. And I almost think about it like climbing this mountain, right? You want to get to the very, very top of the mountain. You don't want to fall short, not get as many eggs as we can get. You also don't want to like push them off the side and get them, have a lot of eggs, but then get people sick. So it's a very, very fine line sometimes.
I had OHSS following the fresh transfer with my twins, and I actually had lots of fluid in my abdomen. thankfully, they never had to drain me, but I have heard lots of horror stories about that happening. This kind of, to me, goes back to the question earlier about fresh transfers versus frozen. And this is definitely one of the risks, at least to me, of doing a fresh transfer.
Absolutely. And I certainly have some patients who have low AMH, not many eggs, and they're not going to get it. But certainly there are some patients who are at higher risk. And that's a discussion to certainly have about what's best for that particular individual patient.
I have also heard of doctors prescribing some medications after retrieval with the hope of reducing the risk. Is that a thing? And what are the medications that you might prescribe?
Yeah, so things like metformin actually can reduce the risk, as well as cabergoline, which is used for hyperprolactinemia. So those are some medications that we can use to try to minimize the risk.
I'm curious about the prolactin one. Why does that help?
I don't think we know. It just seems to.
Sorry, that was not meant to be a trick question.
No, we don't understand the pathophysiology, but we do find that women who are, it doesn't necessarily reduce the chance of getting hyperstimulation. It reduces the chance of severe hyperstimulation, which is really what we want to avoid people getting sick.
Let's talk about ectopic pregnancy. This has come up in several episodes, I'm sure, but what exactly is that?
An ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy not in the uterus. So typically it's in the tubes. It can be other places like the cervix, the ovaries, or the abdomen.
How common is this? And is it more common following IVF than with spontaneous pregnancies?
In the general population, ectopic pregnancies occur in about 5% of pregnancies. So pretty common. With IVF pregnancies, it's obviously it ranges, and I do think it ranges partly because sometimes of technique, but typically we see it in about 1% of IVF cases. So it's certainly much less following an IVF pregnancy, because remember, in a spontaneous pregnancy, the embryo has to like travel through the tube and can often get stuck. In a IVF pregnancy, it doesn't have to do that. So the question is, like, if you're putting an embryo in the uterus, how does it get into the tube, right? And I think that it can be one of two things. One is sometimes there's some hypothesis, maybe the embryos are abnormal. But there's also hypothesis that maybe if you think about uterine receptivity, if the uterus is not receptive, that embryo is going to try to find a place that is receptive. And sometimes it finds a tube.
Is there anything that could be done to minimize this risk?
A little bit. Some of it we can't prevent, but transferring not too close to the fundus. There's been some studies that look at people who get embryos transferred really, really at the very, very top of the uterus, that they can have an increased risk of ectopic. Guideline from the American Society of Reproductive Medicine that says sort of 1 to 1.5 centimeters away from the top of the uterus is a good amount. I often, and this is not really based on a ton of science, but if patients have had a prior ectopic pregnancy, I'll pull the catheter back even a little bit further. So really keep it at that 1.5 centimeters. I'll often give patients some Valium to really cause the uterus to relax and not contract, with the idea of like, maybe it won't push it up, but that one's not based on science. So yeah, I mean, I certainly think there, and then I certainly think if you've had a history of an ectopic before another transfer, maybe an ERA, endometrial receptivity assay, may be a helpful tool.
Mock transfers were also mentioned earlier in the listener questions. Does a mock transfer maybe help with figuring out the best position to avoid this?
We don't do a ton of mock transfers, but mock transfers, I think, are typically to help with people who have like difficult cervixes, so that you know which angle the cervix sort of bends, and not necessarily sort of where in the fundus to put it. Because once you get in through past the cervix, you can place the catheter wherever you want.
Let's talk about bleeding or infection following retrieval. What exactly does this mean and how common is it?
Obviously, we have to stick a needle into your abdominal cavity, and it's a small needle, but it's certainly bigger than getting your blood drawn for a routine basis. It's closer to the needle that you get if you've ever donated blood. It's a little bit of a bigger gauge needle, and we have to like put it through the vaginal wall into the ovary. And we don't just like put into the ovary once, right? We have to sort of reposition it to be able to drain all the follicles. And then we have to do it to the other side. And as you can imagine, the ovary has lots of blood vessels. There's a lot of blood vessels from the uterus that go down into the vaginal area. And so sometimes you can either hit peripheral vessels that are going into the vagina or ovarian vessels. vessels. And the chance of that is probably about 1 in 1,000. It's very low, but certainly, and if you're somebody who has a bleeding disorder, or sometimes patients are taking supplements that increase their bleeding risk. So I usually tell my patients to stop any extra vitamin E or fish oil. Sometimes we see that increases bleeding risk, right? Or people who are on aspirin, that certainly can increase their bleeding risk. So I think that it's just really important to know that it's rare. People who have bleeding disorders certainly are at higher risk for it. And the question is do you completely avoid IVF in a patient who has bleeding disorders? And I think that's a very individual decision. But obviously, we're putting a needle into the body. And regardless of where you put a needle, if you stick your body with a needle, there's always a chance of bleeding. But the risks are very, very low.
I actually had internal bleeding after my second retrieval and had to be hospitalized for it. It was fairly severe. My nurse told me that I shouldn't have laid down after the retrieval, and that might have contributed to the blood coming up into my abdomen and surrounding my diaphragm. I don't know if there's any other advice that you have other than that.
I have never heard that. I think if you're bleeding internally, it's going to be uncomfortable no matter what. And you didn't cause that, or you can't cause that, right? The hard part from the physician perspective, often it's not like an arterial bleed, it's a venous bleed. And if you go in and do surgery, you can't really even sometimes get it stopped or see where it is. So often we just do what you had, and we just sort of follow people over time and give them a blood transfusion if needed. And we try to avoid surgery.
I should clarify, it wasn't my nurse, Sarah, I love you. It was the emergency nurse that told me this was all my fault.
Baloney.
I have been thinking this horrible. All these years, that this was my fault.
Well, 5 years into this podcast almost, and I'm glad we got that one settled. It was not your fault, you bled.
Let's talk about multiples pregnancies. We had an entire episode on this, I realize, but briefly, what are the risks to the mother of being pregnant with multiples?
There's a lot of risks with multiples, including risks. I mean, clearly our bodies are made to carry one baby at a time. So things like gestational hypertension, preeclampsia, preterm labor. So there can be a lot of extra pregnancy complications from having multiples.
How common is a multiples pregnancy when doing IVF?
So obviously, it really depends on how many embryos are placed, whether they're PGT normal or not. So if you're somebody who's putting in just one embryo, there's about a 1% to 2% chance that it might split. If you're putting more than one embryo in, it really depends on who you are, what your prognosis is, what the embryos are like, but it can be anywhere between 15 and 40%.
So other than putting in one embryo versus two, is there anything else that could be done to minimize the risk?
I think this is a good question. You know, there's been some thought maybe assisted hatching can increase the risk, and there's been some studies on it. So the question is, should you not have hatching? Well, let me tell you, I think that I would recommend you follow the protocols, get the best success rates from the lab that you're in. I don't think you need to sort of skip hatching, because that might decrease your chances of pregnancy in general. So my recommendation is follow the American Society of Reproductive Medicine guidelines. Certainly, we both know there are people who come in and say, "Doc, I want twins." And then we have to have this conversation of, "No, you don't. And this is why." And I have to bring up situations like the heartbreaking situation that happened to you. I actually had a patient who came to see me this week. She wasn't actually my patient. She was another doctor's patient who I was doing her transfer, and she wanted to talk to me before doing her transfer. She was not following ASRM guidelines, and she's not my patient, right? So it's like, you don't want to step on anyone's toes and stuff. But I sort of reviewed with her, like, why aren't you following the ASRM guidelines? Because it seems like your doctors recommended that. She kind of got upset with me when I was talking to her about risks of twins. But the truth is that a lot of twins are born so early, they don't survive. Also, a lot of twins are born so early that then you have two children with lifelong problems. One baby is certainly the healthiest, and that's always our goal.
We see so many twins in society that were born to term and everybody is fine. I think that that's very confusing to patients, obviously, myself included. And the ASRM guidelines have changed since I did that, but
yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think it's confusing.
Absolutely.
There are also pregnancy complications that can happen with a singleton pregnancy. What are the common ones following IVF?
things like preterm labor that's slightly high. We also see things like lower birth weight. So there are certainly some complications we see from singleton pregnancies. On the mom's side, certainly there's slightly increased risk for things like ICU stay, postpartum hemorrhage, need for hysterectomy, which is obviously incredibly rare, gestational hypertension, that kind of thing. Obviously, the risk is really low. Certainly, we don't totally understand why IVF pregnancies might be slightly at higher risk. And, you know, the question is it the chicken or the egg, right? So is it that just like the cancer risk, women who need fertility treatment are in general, not everybody, not to offend, but in general, older, heavier, diabetic, hypertensive, and maybe have genetic disorders that predispose them to have a baby with a problem or a pregnancy with a problem. So it's treatment based or whether that these are just patients, myself and you included, who are at slightly higher risk for complications.
I take it because we don't know exactly why this is happening, that there's probably not much we can do to minimize the risk.
Well, so there's the question, right? Obviously, reducing risk, like making sure we have singletons, but like it's hard as a doctor to tell a patient you don't think they should get pregnant, right? It's very, very rare that I tell people I don't think they should get pregnant. Mainly due to things like uncontrolled diabetes, which can lead to very high risk of birth defects. Certainly some cardiac conditions have a very, very high rate of death. And so we recommend gestational carriers. But I think really in general, you know, we try to help as many patients as we can. I mean, certainly the alternative is we are more selective and tell patients they can't do treatment. The question is sort of risks and benefits. So if the risks are low, then the patient and the doctor need to choose to sort of proceed knowing that there are risks.
This is a random aside that I am just throwing at you, so I apologize if you don't have a great answer. But for listeners who don't know, I have epilepsy, and it has been fairly uncontrolled since I was diagnosed in 2017 after the birth of my daughter. And I actually was just told this week that because they continue to be uncontrolled with pregnancy-safe medications, I should probably consider a gestational carrier at this point if we want to have more children so I can switch to a more effective medication. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I think that sort of maternal risks and fetal risks are something that's really important to weigh. So if you have uncontrolled high blood pressure, if you have epilepsy, if you have a history of certain other medical conditions, cancers or whatever. I mean, a lot of people who don't have active cancer certainly and are fine once they've beaten it. But I certainly think there are medical conditions, and they're mainly things like, you know, renal failure, cardiac anomalies that you were born with, certain things that really put people at high risk. And it's really a decision between you and the high risk OB about sort of what a pregnancy would look like with that medical condition. And I know we've done a bunch of pregnant episodes about this, but those are hard decisions. Every pregnancy is a risk to your life, right? I mean, every pregnancy is. And every time we do IVF, there's risks, but overall, the risks are low and the benefits are high. And that's why we continue to do them. But if you have a medical condition where the risks outweigh the benefits, that's where we need to start thinking outside the box.
Let's move on to the baby side. Preterm birth. How exactly is preterm birth defined? Because I think there's some confusion about this as well.
Preterm delivery is before 37 weeks. So anything that's 36 weeks and 6 days and earlier.
And there are also levels of prematurity, right? There's like micro, preemie, and everything like that as well.
Yeah, obviously, the earlier you deliver, the higher risk and more complications there are. So, you know, I think that there's the sort of very late preterm deliveries, sort of between 34 and 37 weeks. They're just a few weeks early versus the ones that are sort of in that 24 to 28 or 28 to 34 range. The earlier a baby's born, the harder it is.
We talked before about prematurity being a risk of pregnant with multiples, but prematurity can also obviously happen with being a singleton. How common is this following an IVF pregnancy?
So it's really interesting. So there have been some studies looking at this, and we see in the general population about 5 to 6% preterm deliveries. With IVF patients, it's maybe 10%. And again, we don't know whether this is because the patients are at risk or because the treatment. We believe that this is likely just because patients are at higher risk.
So again, I take it there's not too much we can do to prevent preterm birth.
Well, the one thing I would say is, you know, if you've somebody, for example, who's had a LEAP and part of your cervix removed, if you're, you know, there's a lot of, and I know we had a whole episode on this, but if you're somebody who has a medical condition that twins would be even more dangerous, don't put in two, put in one.
There are other risks of multiples to the baby. So beyond prematurity, what are those risks?
So we think about things like low weight. There's certainly an increase in babies who are born at a certain gestational age that are low birth weight. And again, this is likely risk factors related to the people who are having, who need fertility treatment. We also think about just sort of general birth defects, which we're going to talk about here in a little bit. The other thing I would say is there's a imprinting disorder called Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome that may be increased with ICSI, where we put the sperm inside the egg. It's rare, about 1 in 14 to 1 in 15,000 babies. And maybe with IVF, it goes up to maybe 2 to 3 in 14 to 15,000. So incredibly rare. When we don't do ICSI, about 15 to 20% of the time, we get zero fertilization. And so typically, if your doctor has recommended ICSI to you, the benefits will dramatically outweigh the risks, but it certainly is something we need to be thoughtful about.
ICSI is fairly common for everyone now, I thought, across clinics.
Yep.
As you mentioned, we are going to talk about birth defects. So what are some examples of birth defects following IVF?
The things we think about, obviously that Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, which I mentioned. And then we think about sort of other random, there's nothing very specific associated with IVF in general. But if you look at the general population, about 2 to 3% of babies have birth defects. When we talk about birth defects, we're talking about like cleft lip, club foot, cardiac malformations, kidney malformations, that kind of thing. And in patients and babies who are born from fertility treatment, not necessarily IVF, but any fertility treatment, there's a slightly increased risk. So instead of 2 to 3%, it's maybe 2.5 to 3.5. So it's just slightly higher. And again, I think this is related to the people who need the treatment as opposed to the treatment itself.
Is there anything that can be done to reduce this risk?
Not really. We're not talking about chromosomal abnormalities like, you know, Down syndrome that can be screened for. We're talking about like cardiac malformations. So obviously being on prenatal vitamins, being as healthy as you can be, but there's really not much we can do to mitigate this risk.
The last topic that I had on my list here is childhood cancers. What childhood cancers have studies shown to be at increased risk of developing following IVF?
So this is a really good one because I think there's a lot of research out there looking at childhood cancers, and there's a little bit of difference in opinion, and it's certainly not well concluded what the right answer is. When they look overall, there was not an increased risk for things like leukemia or Hodgkin's lymphoma. The one that they maybe saw higher risk was hepatic cancer. But when they looked at babies born from IVF, you know, they couldn't find any difference with different kinds of IVF techniques. So ICSI or PGT, they didn't associate that with anything. And I think that's still quite controversial that maybe there's some hepatic cancer increased risk. But I think that overall, the risk of childhood cancers is incredibly low.
So again, this is probably not something that we can do anything about in terms of minimizing the risk.
Right. And I would say that a lot of these studies really concluded that they couldn't determine whether the risks were because of the IVF itself or because the maternal risk, the baby growing up in the maternal environment with somebody who is at higher risk put them at risk.
One thing I wanted to add, I'm not sure if it falls under any of the categories that we already covered, but I had a subchorionic hematoma with my daughter, which we suspect at least partially dislodged her placenta and caused all sorts of problems. She was born at 33 weeks. She was only 3 pounds. She had stopped growing in the womb, and she actually stopped moving, which is why we ended up doing an emergency C-section. Is this type of situation more common in IVF?
I don't know about the data. I'll be honest. I haven't looked at that data specifically. I will say that for people who've had miscarriages or people who have issues with blood pressure or maybe fertility, they may be at risk for like vascular issues. So issues with placental perfusion. And so my guess is, and I don't know the data on this for sure, but my guess is it's slightly increased in patients who go through fertility treatment, just because I think they're probably at higher risk, but I don't have any specific numbers for you.
I know that subchorionic hematomas are fairly common in lots of different pregnancies.
Yeah, regardless. I think at least 50% of pregnancies have them.
Right. So is there anything that we can do to reduce the chance of developing them? I had one in every pregnancy I've ever had.
Really, a subchorionic hematoma is when the placenta grows into the uterus and sort of connects, it can sometimes hit a blood vessel. And that's what a subchorionic hematoma is. So it's really nothing you have any control over.
Well, that's disappointing. I was hoping I could avoid it in the future.
I would say that if you are somebody who's on a blood thinner, right, blood thinners aren't going to cause you to bleed, but if you do bleed, it can make it worse.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to this episode today? Hopefully, maybe some good news?
Yes. So what I would say is we've certainly talked about a lot of doom and gloom today. What I would say is that if you didn't have to do fertility treatment, you wouldn't be doing it, right? Like this is treatment for people who aren't getting pregnant on their own or people with genetic risks, right? And so I think that it's important to realize that any treatment you do for anything always has risks. But really with IVF, the risks are so low, maybe 1 to 2 in 1,000 for any of the stuff we've talked about. And it can sound scary talking about risks, but you got to take it with a grain of salt. Rare things are rare. And the benefits dramatically outweigh the risks. And so it's really important to sort of just understand what the risks are, but be able to take those with a grain of salt because the benefits are just amazing and the risks are, in general, are low.
Going to wrap up with one more positive message. What words of hope would you offer to patients who are starting their first or their next IVF cycle listening to this episode?
So like I said, I think that it's important to talk to your doctor, be able to have open discussions about what your particular risks are and if your risks are higher than other patients. But it's really important to sort of understand, but also be knowledgeable about the fact that the risks are low. And, you know, some obviously anything in life, there are some risks. And as long as the risks are low, it is worth it at the end. So just keep going.
Again, if you have a fertility question you'd like Dr. Rogers to answer in an upcoming episode, go to beatinfertility.co/ask. Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.